He's one of the chosen few to be raised in the wilds of the Alaskan Arctic. Ever since his parents built a homemade sod house on the Kobuk River, Seth Kantner has identified intimately with the lands he grew up in. Today, he's a respected Alaskan writer and photographer who also works as a commercial fisherman and wilderness guide to help others taste and see what nature wants to show us about the Arctic. Seth is joining us now on Travel with Rick Steves from his home in Kotzebue. It's the gathering point for excursions up the region's rivers and into the gates of the Arctic, Kobuk Valley National Park, and the Brooks Range. Seth, thanks for being with us.
Likewise, I appreciate it, Rick. I really do.
So tell us just briefly where you live. It's just fascinating to me when I look at the map, your corner of the United States.
I was born and raised on the Kobuk River, which is about 100 miles above the Arctic Circle. These last maybe quarter of a century, I've spent part of my time on the coast, which is Kotzebue, a town of 3,000, probably about 40 miles above the Arctic Circle. I tell people that peninsula that almost touches Siberia. I live on the north side of that. Yeah, it's home and everything is normal.
Everything is normal.
Yeah, when I go to the lower 48, I don't understand how people survive the harsh conditions of traffic and, you know, where to find food and that type of thing.
Isn't that interesting? So there's a bit of culture shock, but also a bit of nature shock. We would wonder how you survive and you would wonder how we survive.
Oh, I'm the one who's right. I don't know how you do it.
Okay, so let's talk about this then, because I'm fascinated by, you know, the land of the midnight sun and all this kind of thing and long, dark winters. Let's talk about winter north of the Arctic in Alaska. What's it like in the darkest depths of winter? Does everybody just fly down to California?
Well, my parents moved to the big island of Hawaii, so I do go down to see them. But yeah, my dad always said, you know, that more and more winters, they sort of pile up in your system and it's harder to face the sun going away. Here, you know, just above the Arctic Circle, we lose the sun or barely lose the sun for a couple weeks. But those other weeks around that, it's just maybe this little bit of orange on the horizon, maybe 19 hours of darkness. That's pretty tough. When I talk to people about visiting Alaska, I ask them immediately, you know, how much do you want to spend and what do you want to experience? And I think the storms of midwinter are definitely something to experience. It's as close as you could probably get to Mars or something like that.
So, Seth, when you do have the dark long nights, is there a longer twilight than we have here in the lower 48? It seems like, I mean, we just have a short twilight.
Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful sky, pastel blues and oranges and greens, really beautiful winter light that stretches on and on because the angle of the sun, it's just below the horizon for many hours. I went down to Seattle in November once, and I couldn't wait to get home to the Arctic where at least I could see all the different colors in the sky. So there's a lot of darkness, but then there's a lot of northern lights at night too. So I used to run my dog team at, you know, full moon or northern lights, and there's a lot of stray light from the stars and moon bouncing off all the snow and ice.
So what is that like? My sister ran the Iditarod, and I just picture her under the moon, just that rhythm. And she's like with the dogs. They're a tight team. They know each other, and there's that shushing and there's the silhouetted trees and the stars brighter than you could ever imagine if you lived in a big city in the lower 48. Tell me what it's like to be mushing your dogs in the middle of the winter in the dark.
I think it's great what you described, but you're describing when the wind's not blowing and you can see your lead dog in front of you. And so there's just a lot of variables, but those cold, still nights, you can hear a ptarmigan, you know, practically a mile away pecking at a willow bud. It's just so, the air is so frozen and there's no bugs and you forget there's even an insect in the world and barely any birds. And so, yeah, there's no stray sound and the sound of your dog's breathing or the runners on the snow and everything. Every time you step on snow, it's some form of squeaky sound of this cold crystals. And I can't believe when I go to the lower 48, all the noise, it's terrifying at first. And then if you come here in the winter and it's not blowing and storming, it's a silence like nowhere else, I would suspect, on Earth.
You know, Seth, I get this sense, or have this hunch, that if you're trying to get from A to B in a dog team and the sea is frozen, it's kind of an express lane to go out and go across the sea rather than on the land trail. Is there something to that?
Yeah, especially like here at Kotzebue Sound, in the fall when it freezes up, I always joke that it's the biggest parking lot in the world. The inner sound here freezes rather smooth, or can. And then, you know, you can go and travel in all directions and cover large distances rather quickly. And I guess I'm saying that rather quickly compared to summer and spring and fall when you can't do that.
Yeah, so the way the bird flies, yeah, it's the same as the way as the human goes when you're dog racing across a frozen lake.
Wintertime, yeah. And I've never raced dogs. I used to have dogs when I was younger, and that was for trapping and hunting. And then all the food came from the land. So, you know, there's just this constant tension of the dog food pile, basically frozen fish and frozen meat. And every day you'd kind of go out and hunt or set nets under the ice for dog food to feed that team for the every day of the year.
Oh, yeah.
And so that provided this huge connection to the land that when snowmobiles arrived, and by and large everyone switched to snowmobiles, that was a huge piece of the connection that went away.
Yeah, the arrival of snowmobiles, I would think, would have an impact on that. Seth Kantner writes about the Alaskan Arctic from his home base in Kotzebue. You'll find links to his books and articles at sethkantner.com. So you talk about extreme cold like it's just a way of life. It's not a big deal. You even wrote about that frostbite, quote, is a way of life where you live. Tell us more about extreme cold and how do you manage with it?
I have a harder time now. I've had too much frostbite, so my fingers are kind of don't work anymore, and my face doesn't like it anymore. But when I was a kid, you know, being a white boy, I desperately wanted to be, brown and native, and I would get as much frostbite on my face as possible because it makes brown scabs that mean you're a tough, cool hunter. And probably wasn't the smartest thing to do. But surviving cold, you know, the clothing and the caribou skin parkas of the old days or muckluck, caribou legging mucklucks were important. And now we order, you know, store-bought warm clothing, but you're still kind of dressed like a spaceman in the winter. And I joke, you know, you don't go out the door without putting on $1,000 worth of puffy clothing and then fight to break the ice around the door so you can jump out into the storm. And there's a balance between knowing what you're doing and dressing properly, but then psychologically, it's incredibly important not to be afraid of the cold. Respectful is one thing, but if you get scared, that probably shuts down your blood vessels a little, and then probably your wise thoughts go away. And keeping moving is incredibly important. I say, you know, I can pretty much stay warm as long as I'm moving and working, and then having enough sense if you do get cold hands to run back and forth and wave your arms, get the, you know.
I guess there's something to that.
Absolutely, yeah.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. Our guest is Seth Kantner, and he writes about the world he knows in the Western Arctic of Alaska, and he cautions the rest of us to the threats of the region's future. His books include A Thousand Trails Home, Living with Caribou, and his debut novel was Ordinary Wolves. You'll find links to articles Seth has written on his website. That's sethkantner.com. So, Seth, you earn your living a number of ways. You're a fisherman, but you're also a wilderness guide. Tell us about your work as a wilderness guide.
Well, what I do is I wait for somebody to get a hold of me, which is pretty rare, every couple, maybe once a year or more or less. And I guided NASA scientists at the Great Kobuk Sand Dunes here. They were studying correlation between dunes on Mars with the dunes here in the Arctic. I guided B-52 BBC, I guess. They wanted caribou footage, and I think all we saw on that trip was a dead mouse. So you never know in the Arctic.
Well, if I was going to go to Kotzebue and hire you to show, just give me some fun, what do people do for kicks? If I just want to be, I don't want to get frostbite on my face just to fit in at school, but I would like to just have fun the way the locals do. What would be some fun activities?
Well, I really like taking people out on the ice with a snowmobile, making sure they're dressed properly and head into the hills across, maybe observe caribou cratering down through the snow to get to their tundra food supply, or muskox up on the top of mountains surviving storms. I guess last year the Filths and Menswear came up, and I took them up to photograph muskox in the hills. It was terribly stormy, which to me is really appealing. I like to show people what the harsh weather can be like, and at the same time take care of them enough that they enjoy being out there. If you came in the summer, I would hope to take you out commercial fishing for salmon, which is pretty exciting. Hiking in June in the hills here on low mountains is magical, because the sun never sets and the amount of wildflowers is shocking, and really harsh, barren ground full of wildflowers.
And Seth, judging from your book, you're clearly clued into the beauty of and the majesty of nature and the importance of taking care of it, and the wisdom and the beauty of making sure the indigenous people are respected and accommodated. And as a tourist, as a traveler, I want to take home something that broadens my perspective. And as a guide, I think you'd want to contribute to that. So we're just about out of time in our conversation, but let's wrap it up by having you share what you'd like me to appreciate about our world better from my visit to your corner, way up in the northwest corner of Alaska. What about indigenous people? What should I appreciate about the Eskimos of Alaska?
I think here one amazing thing is people's humor when they're out on the land, and humor when basically things are not going the way you want them to. And so I think that adaptability to uncertainty is pretty amazing here in the native population. As far as the land, I would want you to get out and be on the ground observing something big, even if it's a billion mosquitoes biting the pucky out of you. I still would want a person coming north to experience the largeness of nature here.
And by the way, I did say Eskimo, knowing that a lot of people in the lower 48 might be might raise their eyebrows. Can he say Eskimo? But I do understand the native people in Alaska refer to themselves as Eskimo.
Certainly in the villages that I'm, spent my life in, yes. I think if you want to just kind of play it safe, politically correct, Inupiaq is the word for the local people here. And if you did say Inuit, which I've heard people try to get me to say, most of the local people I know don't know that word and have never heard it and don't use it.
Ah, so that's just something I'll learn when I come to Alaska with a good guide. Also, you're so close to the people and the heritage and the nature. What would I learn about the impact of climate change on your corner of the world by actually visiting that I might not be aware of if I didn't take the initiative to go there and experience it firsthand?
Well, Rick, I think it'd be really hard to land here on a plane and be able to see climate change as well as we can, because living here and then living off the land and gathering food from the land, all those changes are in our face and incredibly important. And so if every time you went to Costco, it was either gone or moved somewhere else, then you would be pretty shook up about where Costco went or Safeway or whatever. But we wouldn't if we visited, the lower 48 and Costco wasn't where you expect it to be. And so if you came north, I think the vegetation change wouldn't be on your radar. The fact that there was no ice north of here in the winter, when there's traditionally supposed to be all ice, all that is sort of terrifying to us, but might not register to you and your first visit.
So you're saying the furniture is all being arranged, the whole infrastructure is being arranged when you live close to nature and you know what climate change is doing to the environment in an environment like Alaska?
Yeah, Northwest Arctic here is supposed to be ground zero for climate change. So we're getting two or three times the world average of rapid change. And then we don't have roads, so we travel on ice. So we need the ice to travel on. And if we don't get it, we miss it. It's hard to function in a normal way without those ice trails.
That's an understatement. You miss it. You're stopped in your muddy tracks without the ice.
Absolutely, yeah. And then the animals are not migrating the way they used to, and the ice is dangerous. You know, there's more people drowning through thin ice and everything that might not show up. But if you came back more than once, then you probably would be shocked how rapidly things are changing here.
Mm-hmm. And finally, maybe what inspires people to be active about taking care of nature is to experience it in its extreme majesty. I'm flying all the way up to Alaska. I want to have something that connects me with the grandeur of nature as a guide. What's one experience you'd want to be sure that you introduced to me?
I would really like you to get up here in September, October, when the caribou are migrating, and get yourself in their path and experience just sort of being surrounded by animals on the move, living their very important own lives.
Mm. And looking at the cover of your book, I see them gathered as if in a piazza of tundra together, a community of caribou. And as we prepare to take that trip to Alaska and experience nature so vividly, people can read your book, A Thousand Trails Home, Living with Caribou. Seth Kantner, thank you so much for sharing your corner of the world with us today on Travel with Rick Steves.
You're welcome, Rick. I hope to see you up here.
I think you will. Seth Kantner describes the pressures of being seen as an outsider to the local culture where he grew up in the Arctic in an extra to today's interview. It's posted at ricksteves.com/radio. In her just-concluded term as the Washington State Poet Laureate, Rena Priest made it her goal to celebrate the poetry of the state's tribal communities and to strengthen our resolve to appreciate and protect the natural world. Rena is a member of the Lummi Nation, and her most recent poetry collection is called Sublime Subliminal. She joined us in our Travel with Rick Steves studio to read a poem she wrote about the salmon that are a mainstay of the indigenous cultures of the Pacific Northwest.
Focus and Circuli, Songs on the Salmon Scale. A salmon is a song sung in rounds, a series of concentric circles like a raindrop on the sea, rippling out and returning. A series of concentric circles, a chorus and a verse, rippling out and returning in a shining body of treasure. A chorus and a verse, a hero, home from adventure, in a shining body of treasure, bearing gifts from the deep. A hero home from adventure, like a raindrop on the sea, bearing gifts from the deep, a salmon is a song sung in rounds.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kasmara Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are managed by Andrew Wakeling. Jerry Frank wrote and performed our theme music. Thanks to Robert Frazier at Feature Story News in Washington for studio help this week. And we'll look for you again next week with another Travel with Rick Steves.